Thanks very much to Ryan Burrow, Steve Bertrand here, as we get set kicking off another week here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. If it's Monday, that means we talk to the folks from Chicago Inno. Jim Dahlke, the associate editor there, and Catherine Davis, a reporter, join us in the studio. Welcome to both of you.
Hey, Steve.
Hey.
Catherine, finally nice to sit in the studio with you. I was on with you a couple of weeks ago, but we were in a remote spot. So now we're face-to-face.
Yeah.
It'll be much better. Okay, so a little bit later in the program, we're going to talk to a former deputy mayor of New York City, Dan Doktoroff. He's written a book about what he did. He was the economic deputy mayor for Bloomberg in the days after September 11th. So he's kind of written a book about how cities can rebuild or recreate themselves. And so I want to talk to him about the future of cities. And he does. He's with Sidewalks, Sidewalk USA. Sidewalk. Do you know that company? It's Sidewalk Labs. Mm-hmm. It's an Alphabet company where they work to integrate technology. And so he's got some interesting things to say about that. Let's start with Chicago Inno, though. And this story, I guess, just broke today, right? That Tempest just picked up $70 million?
Yeah, $70 million for a Chicago cancer-fighting startup called Tempest. You might know Tempest from the former founder of Groupon, Eric Lukofsky. So this is his next gig, launched Tempest about a couple years ago. Started out sort of self-funding the whole thing, and just today raised a $70 million round.
Right, a remarkable story, because here he is in the doctor's office. His wife is diagnosed with cancer. He's got a trucking company, right, a trucking technology company, and he realizes that the truckers who use his software have more digital information than the doctors who are treating his wife for cancer.
Yeah, Echo Global Logistics, one of his other mini companies that that Eric is working on. Yeah, he realized that we had more data, more analytics around trucking logistics than we did around cancer. So really what he saw with his own personal experience with his wife being diagnosed with cancer is, hey, we need to give doctors more data, and that's what Tempest is really all about. So Tempest is using machine learning and genomic sequencing to better understand a patient's tumor and then to tailor treatment to the specific patient.
So the idea is all of these tumors that are out there, there will be data specific about them. They'll plug in the patient's data, their genomics information, and you might get out a match to see how it was treated in the past.
Exactly. See how treatments have worked on very specific tumors in the past. If you have a tumor that's like that, then you're able to sort of use that treatment for that patient.
Catherine, $70 million is that's a lot of cash, but it seems like that's becoming a little more common.
Yeah, this round for Tempest is definitely in line with a bigger pattern of big funding rounds for startups in Chicago. You know, we used to see just, you know, startups raising just $5 or $10 million, but now it's in the tens of millions. Just last week, raised $60 million. Outcome Health raised $500 million earlier this year. So definitely in line with a bigger trend.
And what do you think is leading to, I mean, is it just coincidence that it's happening now, or is there a sort of a change in the way these venture capitalists are funding things?
Well, what I think we're seeing is, for one thing, it's serial entrepreneurship. I mean, you look at what Eric is doing and Brad Keywell at Uptake. I mean, these are guys who have been around the block and done it before. And so they've kind of proven the ability to build a company. And we're starting to see more experienced entrepreneurs in Chicago. And we're starting to see a lot more outside money decide that they're going to invest in Chicago. We saw a lot of Silicon Valley money put money into Raise. As Catherine mentioned earlier, that's the gift card marketplace startup. So we're really starting to kind of see the national venture capital landscape, kind of see what's going on in Chicago and really put a lot of money into the startups here.
All right, you know, I like to travel to Europe, take people on tours. And when I do, like, I try to figure out at least some basic language so that I can say thank you and give me another beer, please, and things like that. And the app that I have used is Duolingo, which is, I think, free. You probably can pay for an upgrade or something. But, you know, it seems to work. The languages are kind of limited, but it's kind of enjoyable. But there's this Chicago company called Fluent Forever, which, was it just today, set a Kickstarter record?
Yes. So Fluent Forever, Chicago-based app, actually from a former Chicago opera singer.
I love that, right? Yeah. So he's got to learn to sing in different languages.
Exactly. And so now he knows 8 languages based on kind of like a self-taught method. And he basically built an app back in 2013. Now he's back with a new version of this app, took it to Kickstarter. And just today, it became the most funded app ever on Kickstarter. Just crossed over $332,000 in a little less than a week.
And so this one, though, Catherine, he charges for, right? So people are going to have to buy in, but he does a little different method, kind of a cue card thing.
Yeah, so it's $240 for a lifetime full subscription. You know, that's really interesting because people don't really like to pay for apps.
Right.
You know, like, nobody wants to pay more than a dollar or two for an app on their phone. So it's, you know, pretty interesting that this app did so well on Kickstarter, because Kickstarter is also a place where people like to fund, you know, physical objects.
Where they're going to get something a little more immediate.
Right.
And so learning a language, too, that's something everyone really wants to do for about 6 weeks. And then it passes. So the idea that someone's going to pay for a lifetime membership, it could be a hill to cross. Is that the right
thing? I think they're finding that a lot of their users are really dedicated. They're seeing their users kind of fall into across the board, but mainly two sort of sections. Retirees, folks who are, you know, a little older and who really want to kind of learn a new language and kind of take this up as a hobby, and also sort of 30-somethings who are really ready to travel and explore the world. And they're really finding that people are who really want to learn a new language are ready to spend.
Well, and you point out, Gabe Weiner's his name. Mm-hmm. We should give him his name. He did it in 2013, sort of a little quieter, and it just took off, right? So clearly what he's doing is working and is popular with people.
Yeah, he's basically built kind of a digital flashcard sort of system where you make the flashcard yourself. So everybody who's been in school knows that flashcards are great, but really what helps you learn the information is if you make the flashcards yourself. So right. It kind of does that in a digital format.
It's like when I prepare to talk to you and Catherine. I write down all my notes. I don't have to look at them during the show because I've written them down. They're in my head.
And you sound so well rehearsed.
Oh, so did that. That was really good. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, Jim Dahlke is going to get a haircut. He doesn't know it yet, but a haircut's coming. Jim Dahlke and Catherine Davis are in the studio as well from Chicago Inno. You should check out Chicago Inno. I was on a lake in Wisconsin yesterday wearing my Chicago Inno t-shirt.
Oh, awesome.
And, yeah, that I was given free by Flanagan. Really, you've given me nothing at all, Jim.
I'd like to have credit for at least half of that.
Okay. All right, so give me half of it, the back half. The writing was on the front. But a couple people said, hey, what's Chicago Inno? And I'm like, it's a really cool site that keeps you updated on the innovation in the city, the tech world, and people. So I think I got a couple more followers for you yesterday.
All right. Yeah, I'm glad that they pronounced it right. Sometimes it's Chicago Inno, Chicago Inno. So, yeah, that's nice.
I hang out with smart people. All right, so I said you were going to get a haircut when we came back. Tell me about this company Shortcut. I tend to read some of these and think that they're doomed, which is unfair for me because I have no imagination. Shortcut is going to come to your house and cut your hair, right? Is that what it is, Catherine?
Yeah. So Shortcut, it's a New York-based startup, and they are like an on-demand service for haircuts and barber services. So, you know, you can sort of operates like Uber. You can call a barber into your house, to your office, to a hotel room. And they also employ people similar to how Uber does. So, you know, cosmetologists can set their own hours. And they're supposed to make more money than if they were working in a traditional barber.
Yeah, they get like 90% of the cut, which isn't bad. But the other thing is they charge a lot.
They do charge a lot.
I mean, I think the haircuts...
Haircuts range from $50 to $125.
That's a pretty big chunk of change, I think, for when you're getting some stranger danger to come cut your hair.
Yeah, and they're going after the male demographic.
Not
too.
Jim's hair, so, but Catherine's hair.
Right, so that's right? The thing, right? So my haircut costs like $14, you know. Right. So like this,
no one would ever guess that. Go ahead.
Because of the hat I wear every day. So yeah, basically they're kind of operating in sort of an interesting model, right? So like Uber worked because Uber was efficient. It was easier to get a ride, and it was cheaper. And so all these Uber for X startups are trying to do what Uber did, but they fail in the latter half. They make it convenient to get a haircut, right? Come to your office, come to your house or whatever, but it's not necessarily cheaper. So I think what we're going to see is for these on-demand apps to really succeed, they're going to have to follow the Uber model in that, yes, it's more convenient and it's cheaper. I'm not sure $125 is going to work for everybody. I don't know how scalable that is, but it is convenient.
It's a good idea, and people don't want to wait. I love the idea of having someone come to cut my hair, but it's also tricky because you don't know. People tend to develop relationships with their barber. All right. Well, I wish him luck. We got a minute or so left, and I want to talk about this company, Packback, which was on Shark Tank, who won $250,000. At the time, they were sort of digital textbooks that you could rent for 24 hours, right? $5 for 24 hours. But they've made a big pivot. Explain for me where they are now.
Exactly. So this was a company that was on Shark Tank, got some money from Mark Cuban, and really have totally kind of pivoted. So now they don't really do the e-textbook thing anymore. Now they are all about using artificial intelligence to help teachers measure critical thinking from their students.
So they will read my essay and figure out the next question from the essay answer, or how does it work?
So basically they are able to use artificial intelligence to look over a student's written response to a question and measure their critical thinking skills. So really this kind of takes it to the next level of not just using a computer program to see whether the multiple choice answer was correct. It's really being more about measuring critical thinking and using artificial intelligence to do that.
So, Catherine, is this about helping teachers teach better or helping teachers understand whether their students have learned better? Is that a trick question?
Yeah, maybe Jim.
I mean, I think really what it is it's efficient for the teacher, right? So rather than the teacher having to necessarily comb through every short answer question, I mean, they kind of, the artificial intelligence component is able to kind of be able to be that grading factor.
So they're
going to
grade the papers.
Right. So that's where the quote unquote artificial intelligence comes in, right? So not only is the computer program just measuring, like, did you get the question right or wrong? It's how well did the student understand the material that they're reading.
Right. Okay. So teachers really aren't going to be necessary anymore.
Well, see, that's the thing, right? So I think what teachers are going to be able to do is to use this in conjunction to their normal grading. So it's not like it's going to replace grading altogether, but it's an additional tool that teachers can use.
Jim Dahlke and Catherine Davis, thanks very much for coming by. We'll see you next week.
Thanks, Steve.
Yep, see ya.
You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Daniel Doktoroff was instrumental in rebuilding New York City after the September 11th attack. He served as Michael Bloomberg's deputy mayor for economic development and writes about that recovery in his book Greater Than Ever, New York's Big Comeback. Now he has his sights set on the rest of us. He joins us on a phone line. Daniel, welcome to the Business Lunch.
Thanks so much for having me, Steve.
Sure. Now, so New York City was forced into a rebirth by its attack. I'm interested in how other cities who are sort of facing slower growth illnesses can learn from what New York did. I mean, the other cities, Chicago and others, aren't facing that sort of dramatic stimulus to act. We're sort of withering. How do we get motivated to make things happen?
Well, I think that's where leadership comes in. You know, you don't always have a crisis to respond to. God knows you don't want to have a crisis like 9/11 that, you know, acts as a catalyst. But you know, that doesn't mean that leadership can't fill that void. You know, after New York had begun recovering from 9/11, you know, it didn't stop us from thinking about the future of the city. In fact, one of the things that I'm most proud of was, you know, 6 years after 9/11, we announced what, in fact, was the world's leading sustainability plan, where we looked at every aspect of the physical environment, transportation and energy and air quality, water quality, even climate change, and developed a 30-year plan to accommodate the growth that we thought was going to be so important for the city's future success.
I'm interested that you
nobody was asking for it.
Yeah, okay, so you looked at transportation in New York, right, and you kind of figured we need, it's not just the train system or the highway system, it's everything. We need to dramatically overhaul transportation. How does that feed a city's growth?
At the end of the day, you got to be able to accommodate more people. So look at a city like Chicago. You know, Chicago's population is roughly flat. And what you want is a city's population to actually grow. Because when a city grows, and grows in terms of residents, in terms of jobs, in terms of visitors, you generate more money, which can then hopefully, at least, be reinvested smartly back into improving quality of life, which attracts more people. That's what I call the virtuous cycle of the successful city. But you have to be able to accommodate that growth. And, you know, as we looked in New York kind of out 20, 25 years and saw that, you know, one of our biggest problems was going to be every subway line, every train line, every highway was going to be completely congested if we grew the way we thought we were going to and actually hoped we could. So we had to find ways of increasing investment on transportation. Now, not everything we tried worked. We actually tried to impose a congestion pricing charge, basically charging people to come into Manhattan below 86th Street.
Something they do, and they do that in London, right? Right, that's done in London.
They do it in London. They do it in Singapore. They do it in Stockholm, and it got defeated by the state legislature. You know all about, you know, state legislatures and how difficult they can be. And now the system has been underinvested in. It's run by the state. And they're talking about doing it again. So in some cases, we were just a little bit ahead of our time. But my point is that, you know, you ask, how can a city that's not facing a crisis kind of think about these things strategically? And you do it because leaders who aren't going to be overly swayed by kind of negative publicity or the impact on their electoral prospects say, we've got a problem or we've got an opportunity. Here's a plan for dealing with it. And then they effectively sell that plan to the public And you know, that's what leadership's about. It's not about responding to the crisis. It's about anticipating the crisis and coming up with a plan and selling it.
I think it was you who said that people who live in cities are willing to pay up to live in a city as long as they see that they are getting some return on what they're paying up.
I think there's no question about that. Now, look, everybody's different, and not everybody can afford to, quote, pay up. And so that was one of the reasons why, you know, we decided that we had to spend $8 billion on producing affordable housing for 500,000 people, because we believe very strongly in the benefit of mixed-income, diverse communities, and that became a real priority for us. Again, doing it at a time when we believed the city was going to grow, but nobody was calling for it. So, you know, it's, yes, New York is unique in some levels. Some people are willing to pay. It's a high-cost place, but that doesn't absolve you of the responsibility of dealing with kind of people at providing housing and other services to people at every income level.
When it comes to affordable housing and helping people who can't pay up, here in Chicago, we're a little giddy in the past couple of weeks heading after Amazon's second headquarters with the hopes of bringing that into the city. And it seems to me that it's nothing but thumbs up or pluses there. Others make the argument, though, that if you bring in 50,000 high-paying jobs or relatively high-paying jobs in the city, you start to squeeze out some of the lower-income people or low-to-middle-income people. I'm just wondering if a development that big, an influx that big into a city can always be good, or are there downsides to it?
It all depends on how you plan it. And so, you know, are you going to create greater capacity for housing and other quality of life aspects like schools and other things at the same time? Or are you going to create excessive competition for limited resources? And you've got to be able to provide capacity if you're going to attract something of that scale. Chicago's fortunate. There's actually a lot of land that can be accommodated, that where additional population can be accommodated. I would think Toronto would be a very good candidate for Amazon's headquarters.
You just said
but
Toronto.
It's still going to be important to plan.
You just said Toronto.
Again? Chicago. Sorry, Chicago.
Thank you. We lost our movie business to Toronto. We don't want to lose Amazon, too. So we're talking to Daniel Doktoroff, who is a deputy mayor of New York City, helped bring it back after the September 11th attacks. He's now the CEO of Sidewalk Labs, which is an Alphabet or Google company looking at integrating the technology and preparing for that in cities in the coming 21st century and beyond. You know, I know that Rahm Emanuel and the city here tends to try pretty hard to work at that. I don't know, how is Chicago doing when it comes to integrating data and technology and preparing for the future?
I actually think Chicago, under Mayor Emanuel, has actually been one of the leaders in thinking about technology and how it integrates, particularly using data. It was, I think, ahead of the curve. And there are a lot of cities now who are beginning to focus on this. What we're trying to do at Sidewalk Labs is look at all this on an integrated basis. And our real goal is to develop a district where we can try out a whole set of innovations all together, and whether that's for transportation or mobility and infrastructure, buildings, open space, even social and community services. Because what we really believe is that we're at the dawn of what I like to call the fourth urban technology revolution.
And that is a pretty amazing thing. So you're saying that where we sit today is sort of the equivalent of where we sat before the steam engine or before the electrical grid or before the automobile, that what's coming next is going to be as transformative as those eras were. And I was thinking of that, and I assume that, you know, just before the dawn of the automobile age, we had no idea the impact it was going to make. So here we are sitting today. We probably have no idea what's coming next.
We don't. And that's what we're trying to really think through and then try and do. And we're going to have to confront lots of really difficult issues as we think about that. But, you know, it's undeniable that the world is changing as a result of the fact that we're all connected, that computing power is growing quite dramatically, that we're seeing new approaches to designing and fabricating buildings, largely driven by digital technologies. And we think that the changes that they will bring about are every bit as significant as that steam engine or the electric grid.
Daniel Doctoroff, the name of the book, Greater Than Ever, New York's Big Comeback. It was great to talk to you today. Thanks very much for taking the time.
Well, thanks so much for having me, Steve. It's great to have the chance to talk to you.
You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Steve Bertrand in on this Monday afternoon. And, well, looky here, Randy Schaefer is in the studio as well, a digital editor for the Chicago Tribune. Randy, welcome back to the Biz Lunch.
Well, you welcome back yourself.
I know. It's like we haven't seen each other in a few weeks. Sort of like Barack Obama and Mark Zuckerberg, maybe.
Something like that.
So Zuckerberg, they're coming clean now a little bit about the fact that there were these thousands of ads. And the Washington Post had a story over the weekend about how President Obama, I think it was after the election, before Donald Trump's inauguration, right?
Yeah, it was during that stretch of time, yeah.
And said, hey, Mark, this is serious stuff.
Yeah, so this Washington Post story was about how Obama tried to give Zuckerberg a wake-up call over fake news on Facebook, face news on Facebook.
Right, right.
And, you know, Zuckerberg initially just kind of dismissed it and said, yeah, that's not really our problem. And so come Thursday, when Zuckerberg got back from his paternity leave, he went Facebook Live and admitted that Facebook had indeed been manipulated, and they would turn over more than 3,000 politically themed advertisements to Congress that were suspected to be purchased by Russian operatives.
So the question is whether this will lead to big changes at Facebook, or whether there should be, or...
Well, if right? Barack Obama gets its way, yes, because he warned that this, you know, it's a big problem and it could happen in the next election.
And so the other thing that, and I'm hearing more and more of, and I don't think anything will come of it, but, you know, the newspaper industry is not really regulated, right? But the broadcasting industry is regulated less than it used to be because it's public airwaves. Facebook has now become sort of a major news source for perhaps a majority of the country. And there are people who are looking at whether there should be some sort of regulations over social media sites.
Absolutely. And that's something that's kind of an issue with so many things technologically wise, is because I think everyone can agree technology develops a lot faster than legislation does.
Right.
And so sometimes, you know, these measures, these rules and regulations, they just can't keep up with how fast technology develops.
But what would be the rationale, other than wanting to police them, I guess, a little bit? Why would they need to be regulated? I mean, broadcast is regulated because they're using, well, they used to be using the public airwaves when it came to TV. They still are with radio. I'm not sure what the claim to regulation would be for social media sites.
You know, and that's a really good question. And I don't know the answer to that either.
Well, let's figure it out, because I want to clean things
up. I do too, yes. It's going to be very interesting.
Okay, here's our plan to fix it. First, I want to get it. Well, I have an Instagram account.
Okay.
And then now I want to get a verified Instagram account. Is that what they call it, verified?
Yes, a verified Instagram account.
Okay, so I am verified on Twitter.
Okay.
Because I could go to Twitter, actually the radio station did, and said, you know, Steve Bertrand does this and this and this, give him the blue check. And I got the blue check a few years ago. My kids were very impressed. I'm not sure it's changed my world. But when it comes to Instagram, people are desperate to get this blue check, and you can't apply for it, right? If you ask, they say no.
Right. So this Mashable piece is about how people will pay anything from a bottle of wine to $15,000 for that much coveted blue check mark.
So they're
Instagram.
Bribing people on the inside of Instagram to get a verified account.
They're bribing a middleman. So what this piece says is there's a middleman that can work with the account holder and Instagram itself. And this individual at Instagram will, you know, illegally, say, hey, I can submit this for verification if you give me X amount of money. And then the middleman will take that pitch to the account holder, mark it up with however much they want, and they'll say, hey, I have an in at Instagram if you give me, you know, this $15,000.
So it comes from Instagram, the mole inside out, rather than the user in.
Yeah, so sometimes there were chatbots, actually. So people who want Instagram verification, they can message these chatbots, which connect them to the middleman. And so this is just absolutely fascinating.
It always comes back to bots with you, Randy Schaefer.
It does, yes. I find them very, very fascinating.
Very quickly, why is a verified check important to Instagram users?
Well, for some Instagram users, like, you know, Selena Gomez or Demi Lovato, two of Instagram's most popular users, it can help them sort out fake accounts. But for some people, it's just kind of an ego boost.
Right.
I'd be lying if I said I didn't like looking at the blue check mark next to my name on Instagram.
That's Randy Schaefer. You can read more of her work at thechicagotribune.com. Thanks for coming by today.
Thanks for having me.